Call this meeting to order of the state of the Labor, Industry, and Finance and Policy Committee. For today is March or February 16th. I can't even get my dates correct. Anyway, and we have quorum. So, Representative Mekla, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I did, Mr. Chair. Read through them. I move to move the minutes.
Representative Mekla moves approval of the minutes from February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2023. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have three bills on the committee today, before committee today, and we'll start with House File 1161, Representative Wolgema. Welcome. And I'll let you move your bill. This is supposed to go to education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 1161 be sent to the Higher Education Committee.
We have the bill in front of us. You want to explain your bill, and do you have an amendment? Yes, you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have an amendment. It is pretty technical in nature. It simply allows the scope to the original intent of the bill. It narrows that scope, and it makes the language of the statute clearer. Basically, we're repealing the exclusionary language, and we're replacing it with inclusionary language that is more easily understood.
Okay, members, you want to move your amendment, the A1 amendment?
Yes, I would like to move that, Mr. Chair.
A1 is in front of us to put the bill in the order the author would like. Any questions? If not, all in favor of the author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Wolgema, do you want to explain your bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm honored to be here before you this afternoon to present House File 1161. We're bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair, because under current statute, faculty teaching classes outside the traditional fall or spring semester do not qualify for union representation. This bill fixes that. We're putting this bill forward for many reasons, so that adjunct faculty will be the largest group who are impacted. As contingent employees, they often have the least protection or benefits. This bill provides affected faculty the ability to enjoy the same benefits and protections as faculty teaching in the fall and spring semesters. They will qualify for all the benefits and protections of faculty teaching in the summer and the fall. And some examples of these protections, Mr. Chair and members, include guaranteed minimum pay, tuition waivers, paid leave, access to professional development resources, and more. It comes down to this. The ultimate goal of this bill is to maintain the minimum threshold for union representation of more than 3 credits or 2 or more classes. The change is expanding that threshold from the more traditional academic year to the modern reality of our year-round higher educational opportunities. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to turn over to my testifier, Mr. Jonathan Bone, from the Interfaculty Organization, to provide more information about House File 1161.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Bone, if you want to give your name for the tape and then proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Wolgemut. My name is Jonathan Bone. I represent the approximately 4,000 professors, coaches, and counselors at the Minnesota State Universities, so our 7 state universities. We are thankful that this bill is being heard today. Right now, we cannot represent faculty that teach only in the summer session or if they're adjunct in a J term. And it's simply because of how PELRA was drafted and how unique our employment situation is versus other state agencies. So currently, under current law, if a person's teaching in the summer, they're not teaching for 67 days, which is one of the requirements to be eligible under current statute, and it's not 35% of a full load. However, in our contract, we have a number of protections specifically for adjunct faculty. And adjunct faculty are used extensively in the summer months because oftentimes tenured and probationary faculty are doing research and publishing papers and the other requirements of the job of being a university professor. So we just wanted to expand the current threshold, as Representative Wolgemut mentioned. So we're maintaining status quo on that. We just wanted to expand to summer months or expand to a fiscal year, so we can cover anyone that meets that threshold.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Any questions of the bill, or the author, or Mr. Bone or Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Quick question, do you have any idea how many faculty members this is going to impact?
Mr. Bone.
Yes. Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for the question. I have submitted a request to the system office to find out. They would be the ones with the data that would let us know. Currently, we don't receive data on summer months from the system because we don't represent any of the people that are employed at that time. I would assume that it's in it's going to be about 100 across the system, so it's not a huge amount. But we do have faculty that called in summer months that wish to have filed a grievance that we can't help.
Mr. Bowen, just so that we get it out, these members are not required to join the union, but you still have to represent them if this bill passes.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, yes. And I'll just note that this is not a financial benefit to the union. If someone is teaching 4 credits in the summer months and decided to join the union, their dues would be $85 a year. So it's not an opportunity for revenue.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. All I would ask is if for some reason it was much more than 100, if you just update us, that'd be great when you find that out.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to do that.
And members, this is going to higher ed, which has that purview over those people. Representative Schultz, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wolgamott. Just wanted to ask along these same lines, are there any specific instances that this bill is seeking to get at? You referenced a few grievances, and I just wanted to see if there was anything in particular that this committee should be aware of for the sake of our Minnesota workforce.
Mr. Bohm.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I don't have specific stories. I'm not on our legal team. I can ask the legal team and get back to the committee. I have personally just been in the office over the summer, taken a few phone calls from faculty at St. Cloud and Bemidji who have wished to file a grievance, but because they only teach in the summer, we're unable to help them. And in addition to that, we want to make sure that those faculty are protected under our contract and the things that we have negotiated for. Right now, I do want to say that the system has done an excellent job of treating those people equitably. Their pay is the same as if they were part of the union and covered under a contract. But there are a few things that they're not provided right now that we'd like to. For example, I don't believe they get a tuition waiver if they're only teaching in the summer. And that's something in our contract that our contingent faculty really value. And it's protection for if we get an unfriendly chancellor or vice chancellor of human resources. Because under current statute, they're not part of the union, they don't technically have to do anything for them. That's involved in our contract. So we just want to make sure that no matter who is in charge, our people are protected.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wolgamott, was there any particular instance that you were hoping to get at with this bill? I certainly don't have any strong opinions towards this bill, but were there any particular instances that encouraged you to bring this forward?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Schultz. Very similar to what Mr. Bone just testified to, just being around St. Cloud State campus, you know, listening to faculty, this is something I know that is important not just to the people that this will impact, but to all faculty to make sure that that all of our faculty members, whether you're teaching the more traditional summer or fall course, or, you know, we know that higher ed is becoming more fluid, there's summer classes, there's J terms. It really is just an issue of everybody wants to make sure that everyone who is teaching on our campuses is able to get those protections.
Representative Schultz. Representative Hussein, you had a question.
I'll wait for my question for later.
You're the only one I have left on my list, so.
All right. Thank you, Wolgamott. For bringing this bill forward, and it's a great bill, and I'm very excited about it. But I just want to have a question. Is it the last stop, or he will go to higher ed or policy, ed policy?
Representative Hussein, this is currently going to, is being re-referred to the Higher Education, Finance, and Policy Committee. It's a combo committee like we are. It does both, but that's where it's going next. And I'm not sure, Representative Wolgamott, do you know what the path is after that?
Mr. Chair, yes. The next stop would be the state gov.
So it's got more stops.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Wolgamott, if you want to wrap up. And
well, thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 1161. And I do want to give a special shout out to those to all of our faculty members, but you know, especially those ones who are, you know, making sure that the fluid nature of higher education for those students who aren't the traditional fall semester, spring semester students. These are the faculty members who are making sure that everyone has access to getting a higher education opportunity. Let's have their backs. Let's give them the opportunity to be defined as public employees and to be able to be a part of the IFO. I ask for your support to send House File 1161 to the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee.
And Representative Wolgamott renews his motion that House File 1161, as amended, be re-referred to the Higher Ed Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill's on its way. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
I see. members, yeah, our next person up, we've got testifiers for the next bill, but the author is not here, and Representative Hollins is the next person, the third bill, and she's here, but her testifiers, again, we're having this issue with similar bills being heard in the Senate the same time we're hearing them here. So I suggest we take about a five-minute break, and so see if we can round up our other author. So we're in recess for 5 minutes. We'll call the meeting back to order, and I see our author is here now. But
the Second Amendment.
We caught a minor glitch in the minutes that there was a correction that needs to be done. So, Representative Mecklen, do you want to renew our?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move to recall the minutes that were approved.
Representative Mecklen moves to recall the minutes that were approved. Everyone in favor of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And Representative Mecklen, I understand that on the minutes we missed on the attendance of the members, Representative Kozlowski was excused from the last minute or the last meeting, and they failed to put that on the minutes. So
that is correct, Mr. Chair. It's not duly noted.
And so we will add that to the minutes that Representative Kozlowski was excused from last meeting's minutes or last meeting. And so Representative Mecklen, you want to move the minutes as corrected?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes as corrected.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes as corrected. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it, and the minutes are approved again. Representative Edelson. And I'll move House File 1056 to be referred to Committee on Taxes. Representative Edelson, want to explain your bill? Is there an amendment to it?
There is an amendment, Mr. Chair.
I will move the author's amendment. You want to explain what that does? And it looks like it's a real big and lot of words to it. Not really. It's a very short, it looks like a technical amendment.
It's really funny, Mr. Chair. I grabbed the wrong amendment from but what the amendment essentially does is it's making it so that if there's not an NDA, that it would also that we would not be able to it would be more all encompassing, and I can explain it in the larger scale of the bill.
Can I move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the way the author chooses? All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Edelson, explain your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1056 would prohibit sexual harassment settlements to be paid as severance when a non-disclosure agreement is included. And in the instance when severance continues to be paid for these settlements, it provides language in Subdivision 2 that these sexual harassment and abuse claims should not be taxed by the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The key differences in this legislation is how it impacts employees and who are the victims of sexual harassment and how the status quo can benefit companies. It's important to think about this in two different paths. In both instances, sexual harassment has been established. With severance, when a settlement is paid out as severance, the victim is subject to paying state taxes on a sum as it looks like wages. The victim experiences further victimization financially because the amount is dramatically reduced based on their tax rate. And it allows the company to deduct attorney's fees. With a settlement, the victim receives more of the award, which they should be entitled to because Minnesota does not pay tax on settlements. In both scenarios, the trauma and the harassment is exactly the same. In both scenarios, the benefit exists of resolving the harassment claim outside of the courtroom. However, it is the tale of two stories with unequal outcomes. What we are talking about is a loophole in the law that benefits companies at the cost of victims of sexual harassment. It takes an attorney 1 minute to change the wording from settlement to severance. This then can further traumatize the victim financially while benefiting the company. We should not, as a state, accept this. NDAs can conceal bullying, toxic harassment in a workplace. Companies, for good reason, are facing scrutiny over NDA cover-up practices. These NDAs do buy silence. By making this change before you today, we can help create a safer workplace that ensures companies are having robust discussions to prevent harassment and abuse in a workplace. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go to my testifiers.
And I've got two testifiers on here. There may be more, but first on my list is Julie Reiser. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Edelson. My name is Julie Risser. In 2014, I signed a non-disclosure agreement with my previous employer for sexual harassment. Back then, I didn't know NDAs really aren't regulated. I didn't have time to investigate. This was before sexual harassment cases made headlines. I didn't know then, but what I had experienced was the norm. I went through common stages of on-the-job harassment. I ignored my harasser, hoping it would stop. I told my harasser to knock it off. The employee handbook messaged zero tolerance for sexual harassment and that victims must report. I reported in annual reports year after year. Nothing happened. I went to HR. The rep refused to document my experience. Later, I learned from a state of Minnesota unemployment expert that I should not go to HR. I shouldn't have done that. HR is there to protect the employer. Zero tolerance means HR denies sexual harassment exists. My contract was not renewed. It's common for people who report to lose their jobs, while those who harass remain employed, get promoted, and gain power over even more people. And that is what happened in my case. I felt and I was isolated. My husband and I needed my job to support our family, our daughters. I hired an attorney. I didn't want anybody to go through what I had. I thought this would make a difference. We reached an agreement. The term in it was settlement, not severance. There was nothing about income taxes. When payment came, I was stunned. It was a sliver of the validation I had agreed to. Even the state of Minnesota got a cut. My unemployment benefits stopped. I couldn't access them until the total of my settlement had been prorated out. I couldn't use settlement funds to retrain. My expertise was narrow. I would have had to move out of state for a job that matched my skills, and that was not an option. My parents and many extended family members are here. My employer benefited. Wages are deductible. Avoiding settlement payment keeps insurance rates down, and paying settlement as severance enables employers to conceal harassment. It means they don't have to reveal risk to insurers. No need to acknowledge the victims. It re-victimizes and shores up systemic gender inequities. I vividly remember seeing the cut Minnesota got from my sexual harassment settlement and also wondering, gosh, I wonder if I'm going to be bumped up to a higher tax bracket. House File 1056 will stop others from having this experience. It will also make it easier for people to retrain and get back in the workforce. There is a labor shortage. I would think there would be a lot of people who would be interested in seeing this pass. Thank you for your consideration. Minnesota can and must do better by victims of sexual harassment.
Thank you, Ms. Rizzer. The next person I have on my list is Artika Roller. And you can just pull another chair down there. And Representative Edelson, is this the the last?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Artika Roller. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We represent more than 66 domestic and sexual assault programs across the state of Minnesota, serving victims and survivors in all 87 Minnesota counties. Victims and survivors of workplace harassment and abuse experience significant trauma and many obstacles to healing, especially if you call their settlements severance. It continues the abuse that they have experienced. I wholeheartedly agree with Ms. Risser that allowing employees to make an abuse settlement payments as severance compounds the harm and allows employers to hide the record of wrongdoing. Severance pay indicates that an employee was simply let go or a reduction in force, whereas a settlement is a more accurate description. A victim and survivors receives less money if they're paid severance because it is subject to federal income taxes, and people who receive severance are also not allowed for unemployment benefits, which causes additional financial insecurity and harm to victims and survivors. Severance pay is also, again, state tax deductible, meaning that an employer can claim a sexual harassment settlement as a business expense on their taxes. Victims and survivors of workplace harassment or abuse faces loss, unexpected medical, mental health costs, and barriers to accessing unemployment benefits. Many victims and survivors lose their jobs or are forced to quit because their safety and well-being are at risk. They may also miss out on career advancement opportunities, that is, and moving forward, losing future wages. Settlements can ease the burden of lost wages, help with medical expenses. A settlement also represents a person's best chance of getting some form of justice. We believe that everyone deserves to be treated with dignity and respect at work. Employers should not be able to hide sexual harassment and prevent their reputation to be damaged by claiming sexual harassment settlements as tax deductions or business expenses. Please vote today to support House File 1056 in the needs of victims and survivors by prohibiting payment of sexual harassment settlements as severance. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience before I go to questions that wants to speak for or against this bill? I got to keep remembering to ask that. We didn't do that when we were in Zoom meetings. If not, questions on the bill? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Edelson. I'm beginning to understand the gravity of this bill and appreciate you bringing it forward and to kind of gain a little bit of an understanding here. And I realize, one, the impacts here to employers and obviously the employees. Would we be creating a new So it's not wages, it's not severance pay, you're creating a new standard for what that payment would be, or how would that be classified?
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, no, we wouldn't be. It's simply saying that in the instance where we, the company and the person that is the victim in the situation, if they agree or if it is agreed upon that there has been sexual harassment, that they would be paid out for a settlement. There is already a pathway for this. It's unfortunately used in situations just like the testifier had talked about, where they come to an agreement, and then when the agreement comes before them, a lot of the people in these situations, of all genders, by the way, are in a certain state of trauma when they're signing this. And then you think about it later as they receive their tax statement and they have to file their taxes. And so, no, we're not. We're just saying that in the instance where this happens, you have to call it a settlement, which is what it is.
Great. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Edelson. That does answer my question, and I appreciate it. And so this would, to gain clarity again, this simply says that there will be no income taxes towards that settlement.
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Just like if there was any certain settlements within state statutes, definitely make that clear. And last year I was really, Representative McDonald was on the committee, and it was bipartisan. I think it's something that happens within all of our districts. I think the questions you're asking are really good, though, and I value them.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Edelson, what is the committee path for this bill, as you understand it?
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, from here it should go to taxes, and I imagine from there it would be laid over.
Representative Edelson.
Oh, actually, no.
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I correct that. I think it would have to go to judiciary as well, and then probably go back either to be laid over in taxes or judiciary. One of the staff know kind of that maybe the CA, Mr. Reese.
Looking at the staff, and we'll find that out. But as from here, it's going to taxes, and you're probably right. It would have to go to judiciary, and we'll see what happens from there. So. Representative Schultz, any further questions? Any other questions of members? If not, Representative Edelson, if you. We're having a discussion of Representative Edelson that if it has to go to judiciary and it's going to go to taxes to be laid over, that it probably should go to judiciary first.
Mr. Chair, actually, you know, as I'm thinking about this, Mr. Schultz, thank you for asking this question, because you're actually helping me. You're helping me so I don't have to go to several different committees. Mr. Chair, if we could amend the motion to have it go to judiciary and then to taxes, I would be grateful.
Just wait a second. Here, go.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Our nonpartisan staff is going to check with the nonpartisan staff board through the Judiciary Committee and can give us a more clear answer, because my reading of the bill, I'm not seeing it, but certainly the language that sends a bill to the Judiciary Civil Law Committee is a complicated one, and so it's part of that.
So, Ms. James, what did you find out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So just to confirm, this bill doesn't have a fiscal cost. So judiciary and civil law would be appropriate, or wherever the chairs want it to be heard.
And I'm assuming that they said taxes because it's going to deal with the Internal Revenue Code. So I'll amend my motion that House File 1056, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Finance Committee. Members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you for your testimony. The next bill we have up, our last bill, is Representative Holland's House File 865. And this is another bill we've heard before past year. I'll move House File 865 be sent to Judiciary Finance Committee also. Representative Hollins, have your testifiers showed up yet? Or?
No, sir, they have not.
We will proceed as best we can. And Representative Hollins, welcome to the committee, and proceed with your testimony or explain the bill. Do we have an amendment on this also? Or?
I don't believe so, no.
I don't see one here either. I just double checking. So, Representative Hollins, you want to explain your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you, committee members. I apologize that my testifiers are stuck in the Senate testifying on the same bill, and also Representative O'Neill is supposed to be joining me to co-present this bill because this was actually hers from several years ago. But I'll do my best to represent for both of us. House File 865 is really a bill about basic fairness and reducing barriers for small construction businesses. It's a common sense bill, it has bipartisan support, and it has the support of 24 organizations, including labor unions, management, the trial lawyers, and the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. It's often referred to as the duty to defend bill because it ensures that each party to a construction contract only has to defend to the extent of its own negligence. The bill realigns the concept of indemnity and defense and revives the spirit of the 2013 indemnity law. It does so by doing three things. First, it ensures that negligent party pays their own legal fees. Second, it aligns the Minnesota practice with the American rule. And third, it removes ambiguity to ensure that the public projects we fund are performed fairly. I think the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs probably said it best in their letter of support, which I believe is included in your packet. Increasing contracting opportunities for disadvantaged businesses, particularly those owned by people of color, is a necessary step in creating a more equitable economy. Oh, yay! Sorry.
Well, continue. Yeah, Representative O'Neill has joined us, and members, we do have a long list of a big packet of letters to people supporting the bill. So,
I'll finish my introduction, and then I'll turn it over to Representative O'Neill for her five cents, whatever it is.
With inflation, it's now 10 cents.
Oh, there we go. Yes, thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's a necessary step in creating more equitable economy. Non-negotiable duty to defend contract terms create barriers for small businesses, thereby hurting our economy and our workforce. Thus, we believe that the allocation of risks should be equitable and that all parties should be held responsible for their own negligence. Ensuring basic fairness to Minnesota construction contracts will help small businesses owned by economically disadvantaged and historically disadvantaged groups, and workers across the state. And I will go ahead and turn it over to Representative O'Neill, with your permission.
Welcome to our committee, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a long time since I've been in front of a labor committee, so I appreciate you having me today. So the reason I'm supporting this bill is I actually used to carry this bill a few years back, and that is because I used to own a construction company myself. So being a small construction company with just a couple of employees, it is very, very difficult being the small fish in a big, huge pond to negotiate a contract with a big organization. I won't name them, you know who they are, but it is very, very challenging. And to take on that risk and that burden and that liability is very, very challenging. It's expensive. It's if things go wrong, it's really expensive. You could have a $10,000 job that for some reason, because you weren't, for example, this is just happening with my son who now works for the company that I used to own. They had something go wrong with a prior contractor, and so their product failed because the underlayment wasn't up to standard, and so they had to replace a $10,000 floor. These kind of things happen all the time, and that burden, even though it wasn't your fault, the fault does fall on you. So to me, this is taking care of the little, tiny, small fish in the very, very big pond. It's a matter of fairness, and it really, especially when you're talking about we want to encourage people of color to have businesses, it's really, really difficult for someone that is just starting out and trying to do a construction and other trades like that. It's really tough. So I'm just here because I actually used to own a company, have walked this walk, and know how difficult it is to negotiate a contract that is fair and equitable to the little guy. So thank you for supporting it.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Questions of the bill? Representative Daniels. A little bit of brotherly love here.
Yes, I thank you, Chair. Representative O'Neill, I just have a question on lines 2.4 to 2.6. If you could explain a little bit about those three lines there. It just talks about the responsibility party of government entities and goes on talking about environmental laws. I'm a little confused on the environmental part.
Representative O'Neill, Representative Hollins.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDaniels.
I'm just trying to tease my sister. Oh, that's there's no need to answer that. I'm sorry.
As I said, a little bit of brotherly love, and yeah. And the our testifiers are on the way. Any other questions while we're waiting here? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the author. I think if I recall last year, and it's the same bill, I presume, as far as I can recall, yes. MnDOT did testify against it. I'm just curious if they are still against it or are they for it now?
Representative Hollins. I believe they're coming on their way here. Representative Hollins.
I wish. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. No, MnDOT is still against it, as is the Minnesota Department of Administration, the airport, and the General Contractors Association. I'm not revealing anything you won't find out in like 5 minutes, so.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, right.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. No, I just thank you for that, Representative Hollins. And then also, wasn't there, is it proper to bring up some testifying that we had last year? Is it pertinent this year still? Is that proper?
I'm not sure, but it probably, you're talking hearsay evidence from last year? Or?
Well, it's all recorded, of course.
It's all been recorded.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just a question. McDonald. Another one. There was an attorney that testified and had some problems, some concerns regarding the in the judicial system, and I don't recall the details. So, the duty to defend in
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you, Representative McDonald. I do recall that as well, and I haven't reviewed that. I was in judiciary when this bill came up, and so I do recall that there were some issues. I know that the trial lawyers are in favor of it currently, and I know that we do have a lawyer testifying on our side about the equity provisions of it. I think that, you know, as a lawyer, I can speak pretty, I think I can speak to this, that you know, we do a pretty good job of choosing whichever side we want to be on and arguing that pretty zealously. And so I could certainly see attorneys on one side or the other being against this. But I really do think that it comes down to a fundamental fairness and asking those groups that have the least among us to protect and pay for the legal fees for the big fish in the sea is just, it's just not fair. It's not equitable. And so that's really what this bill is getting at.
And is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on it? I see we got other people coming, but if you can testify while we're waiting, if that's your desire. Welcome to the committee, please. Again, state your name for the record. And
you weren't going to yell at me.
I'm not going to yell at you.
We're all nice. We all try to be nice here.
Everybody's nice. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Kirk Peterson. I'm one of the lobbyists for Hennepin County. I hadn't planned on testifying on this bill today, as others are going to be here shortly to do it. But we do have some concerns with this bill. But before we get to that, Mr. Chairman, I do want to point out that Hennepin County and others are very interested in talking to some, addressing some of the concerns that Representative O'Neill addressed as far as including more diversity in our contracting and procurement methods. As the chair knows and other people know, we have several pieces of legislation moving that would allow us to increase especially our small business contracting with minority-owned, women-owned, and veteran-owned companies. We're really trying to get more business into locally-owned business, locally-owned contracting firms to really help address those. The concerns with this bill are slightly separate, as you will hear in more detail once people get here that actually know what they're talking about. But, Mr. Chairman, if you would like, I can just briefly read some remarks from our county attorney that kind of go into more specifics on this. Or do you want me to wait for the other people?
Mr. Peterson, why don't you go ahead and read the notes from the county attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll read slowly. basically, the primary reason that we have concerns with this bill is that even though Section 337.02 specifically prohibits agreements that require a subcontractor to indemnify a general contractor for its own fault, and also prohibits agreements that would require a general contractor to indemnify an owner of its fault, it does not explicitly preclude agreements that would require a subcontractor to defend a general contractor for its own fault. The lack of an express prohibition of a contractual duty to defend is far more significant than the current statute's prohibition of a contractual duty to indemnify. The overwhelming majority of construction cases in Minnesota are never tried, and therefore a binding determination as to the extent of a subcontractor's indemnity obligation is relatively rare. Instead, most construction cases are settled, and one of the reasons for that is because the subcontractors have typically been held responsible for paying a general contractor's defense costs, irrespective of the merit or lack thereof of the underlying claims. Consequently, what really drives construction cases in Minnesota is responsibility for the cost of defense. Because come on, people. Because the current statute does not specifically preclude an agreement that would require a general contractor to defend an owner for claims arising out of the owner's own alleged fault, owners can argue that general contractors have an independent duty to defend the owner in its, of its own fault, irrespective of the existence of a duty to indemnify the owner. The duty to defend is distinct and broader than the duty to indemnify in the context of insurance coverage, and there are several court cases, if you need, that I can reference on that. So as an owner, Hennepin County, and more generally, I'm going to assume that other counties and cities and public organizations want its general contractors to have a contractual duty to defend the county even when liability is disputed. Otherwise, general contractors and their insurers would always attempt to avoid incurring the cost of defending the county by claiming the county was at fault, wholly or in part. The proposed amendments to the law would modify the definition of indemnification agreement in 337.01 sub 3 to include the duty to defend. And that is where we find some concerns, Mr. Chairman and members. That is the end of my email. So unless you want to keep babbling on other issues, Mr. Chairman, I can be done.
Again, why don't we thank you, Mr. Peterson. Representative Hollins, why don't we take a hopefully a 5-minute break and recess for 5 minutes, and hopefully by 5 minutes to 2 or 2 o'clock, we can, our testifiers will be here and we can continue on the bill. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is there are 3 testifiers heading here now and 2 more also on their way.
I heard a door open.
But we can take a break. That's
you can fine. Take a breath. Yeah, we'll take a recess again for five minutes, and when they get here, we can get started again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, let's get started. I see our testifiers have showed. Some of our testifiers have showed up. So let's get restarted. Anyway, Representative Hollins, I see we have one of our testifiers here, and is this Patrick? If you want to identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Patrick Lee O'Halloran. I'm chapter counsel for the Minnesota Subcontractors Association. I'm also an attorney in private practice. I've specialized in construction law for more than 20 years. Thank you for hearing this important bill. I ask that you pass it. This bill is needed because there is a significant imbalance in bargaining power in the construction industry. This imbalance has led to an unfair practice of shifting legal costs and construction costs by contract onto the smallest subcontractors in Minnesota. I'll provide a little bit of overview and history and walk through the bill. In 2013, the Minnesota legislature amended the anti-indemnity statute to make it clear that indemnity agreements in construction contracts could only hold contractors responsible to the extent of their own fault or negligence. This may seem like common sense, but this had to be passed at the time. After that 2013 law was passed, lawyers for general contractors immediately started drafting contracts with onerous defense provisions to try and get around the indemnity law. They increased the obligations to defend general contractors even if they were solely negligent. In your materials, you have an excerpt from an actual contract between a general contractor and a disabled veteran subcontractor on a MnDOT job. The general contractor on this publicly funded job is requiring the subcontractor to pay for all of the general contractor's defense and legal fees throughout a dispute, even if the subcontractor didn't cause damage and cannot be required to indemnify the general under Minnesota law. Today in Minnesota, subcontractors are regularly being contractually required to defend the general contractor, even where the general contractor is solely negligent. This unfair practice creates a host of problems. For example, these duty to defend clauses are common and often non-negotiable. So subcontractors are being required to sign these as a condition to do the work. So they either have to sign the contract or forego the work. If a subcontractor wants the job but doesn't want to agree to those terms, it puts the onus on that subcontractor to incur additional legal fees to try and negotiate away those terms. If the contract is signed, these terms impact the way subcontractors approach the entire job, and the terms may chill the subcontractor's use of other legal remedies in their contracts, leaving many subcontractors to feel they have no legal options. We also know this practice hurts disadvantaged business enterprises trying to make headway in the industry, as they face increased risk and costs to cover this risk shifting. Here's a quick quote or two from the 2017 Minnesota Joint Disparity Study on the Airports Commission. Quote, duty to defend contract requirements, retention withholding, and prompt payment issues cause challenges for small firms in the Minnesota marketplace. And another, public sector insurance requirements are a barrier to businesses seeking public sector prime contracts and subcontracts. If a claim does arise, subcontractors can and do face the risk of significant liability even if the claim arises outside of their control and even if they are not responsible for it. If the claim is going to be settled, which most claims are, the first thing the parties will look at to determine who pays is the contract language, often with the same terms as the one before you. So yes, unfair settlements are structured because of this practice. When a similar risk transfer practice afflicted the Minnesota trucking industry, the legislature passed a law to prohibit it. That's Minnesota 221.87. The trucker statute used the same indemnify, defend, and hold harmless language as this bill proposes. Across the country, over 40 other states have varying degrees of anti-indemnity laws. Numerous states have near identical laws limiting indemnity and defense to the same extent this bill proposes, including Iowa, Oklahoma, Colorado, and Montana. I can give you the specific sites if you so like. Passing this bill will not make Minnesota an outlier. It would make us follow the more common trend, which is limiting unfair risk transfer to a reasonable extent. Now I'll walk you through the bill, which has three parts. For ease of understanding, we'll start on page 2. Section 3, line 2.22, simply adds the word defend to the definition of indemnification agreement in 337.01. This closes the loophole that I talked about at the beginning of my testimony that allows a negligent party to make someone else pay for and insure their legal costs. Just like the current law for indemnity agreements, the addition of the word defend means that separate defense obligations would only be enforceable to the extent of the party's own fault or negligence. It's the same thing we did to the indemnity statute 10 years ago. It's worked very well in practice. There's no reason we can't do that with the word defend. Section 4, line 3.3, deletes the term project-specific insurance. This is ambiguous wording, which some have tried to argue creates a full exception to the anti-indemnity law. If you would like an article explaining that ambiguity or to see a letter from a general contractor trying to exploit it, we can certainly provide you those materials. Sections 1 and 2 ensure parity between public and private projects. They do that by taking current statute from 337 and the changes I just mentioned and put all that into the public section of statutes 1571 and 15.72. Many believe that Chapter 337 already applies to public projects, but some have argued that it doesn't or that it is vague. I don't share that view, but this is belt and suspenders and would make that crystal clear. It is important to note, if the bill is passed, a general contractor can still require a subcontractor to pay for and insure the general contractor for any costs related to the sub's own fault or negligence. The right to require somebody responsible for the own fault is protected by 337.02. The right to require insurance coverage to protect for vicarious liability is protected by 337.05, subdivision 1D. Again, this bill doesn't change that. Section 2 of the bill would offer those same protections in Chapter 15. There is a lot of support for this bill. 24 organizations, including a host of trade unions, the trial lawyers, state agency, and many construction employer associations. In the past, some public owners in the AGC have raised some concerns. We've had many meetings with them over the years to try and understand their concerns. We've asked for suggestions and will continue to listen, but the status quo needs to be changed if we want clear and fair public policy. This bill is about fairness and removing barriers for small and emerging businesses, as well as leveling the playing field for contractors using reasonable contract terms. Please pass House File 803, and I'll stick around for any questions.
Mr. O'Halloran, I just point out when you said Section 3, where they added the word defend, that's actually Section 4 of the bill.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's okay. I just want to make point it out in case somebody listening. Any questions of this testifier? If not, The next person on my list is Tamara Sunby. And people say stick around if there are questions at the end. We hopefully can get them answered. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tamara Sunby, and I'm a proud owner of GTS HVAC Incorporated. Thank you for allowing me to share my industry experience today. We are a woman-owned, disadvantaged business enterprise HVAC company. We've been in business for 17 years and have 3 trucks in the field. We hope to stay in business for another 17 years so I can pass my business down to my sons or daughters. But many of the contracts that we are being asked to sign could put us out of business in the blink of an eye, or for someone else's mistakes. The defense demands that some general contractors and public owners are requiring put my business on the hooks for their actions and their lawyer fees. It's not fair, it's not right, and it's got to be fixed now. Why should I pay for or insure someone else's mistakes, especially someone who I have no authority over? I ask myself seriously, is this even legal in Minnesota? Public owners are begging small women-owned, minority-owned, disadvantaged business enterprises like myself to come on board to these projects. Yet, they're expecting me to sign these unfair contracts. You have an article in your materials about MnDOT failing to meet their own disadvantaged business enterprise goals. In that article, it actually feels like they're blaming us, the DBEs, for not meeting these goals. But how can I even consider these jobs when I have to sign their non-negotiable contracts that put me on the hook for a giant project? I have had to turn down a number of jobs or potential job opportunities, both public and private, because of these non-negotiable defense provisions. It's impacting the growth of my business, and I've also had to hire attorneys to argue terms before I even get the job, which means I'm paying for the project I may not even get, and if I am lucky enough to get that, it's already cut into my margin, so when I show up on the job site, I can't make any mistakes. I know many of my peers are signing these contracts so they can get work, and I know many of them are signing contracts they don't even understand what they're committing to, or worse yet, they're being shamed or bullied into signing them. This leaves only a legislative option, which means we need your help. I'm testifying today because I want to help end this unfair, absurd practice for myself and others. It's a bit daunting, but I'm proud to be testifying with another woman-owned business owner who's willing to stick up for our industry, even though others are afraid of doing this because they could face backlash. Please pass House File 865 and bring some common sense back to Minnesota contracts. And thank you very much. I will stay for questions if you need to.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. The next person on my list is Alida LaPlante. Again, welcome to the committee. The next person I have on my list after this so you can get ready is Jim Crony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you very much, Tamara. My name is Paulita LaPlante of Inver Grove Heights. I'm the owner of CSO of Prescription Landscape Incorporated, a woman-owned business enterprise founded in 1980, headquartered in St. Paul, Minnesota, with branch offices in Crystal, Shakopee, and Sauk Rapids. Duty to defend reform is important to equity in construction contracts. Ending it will prohibit the practice of using contract clauses and project-specific insurance to compel subs like us to assume responsibility for the payment of legal costs and attorney's fees for litigation arising from work and negligence of another party. We are a privately held, locally owned commercial landscape company with approximately $40 million in revenues, depending on snowfall totals. We employ a year-round staff of 150 and grow to twice that size in the winter. We have multiple land care service lines, one of which is landscape construction. That service line is our only union division. It's less than 10% of annual revenues. Most of the jobs we bid are very large, so we routinely subcontract aspects of the landscape work to WBE, MBE, SBE, and DBE subs with whom we've had years-long relationships. This helps their businesses since we pay for the insurance to indemnify their work and can afford the bid bonds when required. While this sounds great, we are leery of growing the construction service line because the contract language from some of the contracts on which we bid can shift all the risk of loss to us if there is even the thinnest nexus between the claim and our work. Unlike Tamara, our company can afford to turn away work if it poses too great a liability risk for us. However, that means we are also turning away work for the people like Tamara, other MBE, WBE, and VBE subcontractors as well. You've had the opportunity to read contract language, but the clause that always causes us to reject work includes the statement, quote, contractors' work or presence on the property, including but not limited to any negligent acts, end quote. The practical effect of that chilling language shifts the entire risk of loss to our shoulders for an unknown universe of claims. We are 100% willing to indemnify and defend our work and that of our subs as it is defined in our contract scope of work. However, when a contract includes broad statements about our very presence on a property, it is easy to see that definitions can become obscured and legal risks heightened. Our insurers rightfully balk. I respectfully request that you pass House File 865 and enable us to continue to grow our business and contribute to the growth of our small business partners. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Jim Crony, and the next person I have is Cameron Boyd. So if you...
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Jim Crony, and I'm Deputy Chief Counsel at MnDOT. I want to start by saying that public project owners certainly support having contract clauses that are fair to all participants in the construction process. We value prime contractors and subcontractors equally. Just for clarity, I just want to point out that no subcontractor signs the MnDOT construction contract. Only the general contractor signs that contract. And our MnDOT contract does not have the type of defense provision that Ms. Sunby identified as problematic. Turning to this bill, this bill, we believe, has some unintended consequences that pose some fairly significant risks to public project owners, and we think these risks will increase the likelihood and costs of litigation on public projects, and I'll briefly discuss two of these risks. First, the bill conflates the duty to defend with the duty to indemnify, and then conditions the duty to defend to the extent of a party's liability. But a duty to defend is and has to be triggered by a claim and not by a finding of liability. So this bill makes it likely that a contractor can refuse a tender of a claim and just say, I'm not responsible for defending this because the extent of my liability has not been determined yet. That would be a pretty inefficient way to handle those claims, and essentially it means that the public project owner could be forced to defend a suit on that project even when the general contractor has insurance that will cover the cost of that defense. Now, in 2022, MnDOT turned 11 tort claims over to contractors. So these are cases that MnDOT investigated, determined that we weren't at fault, and we turned these cases over to the contractor for resolution. Now, these weren't lawsuits. These were claims that came in through an administrative process. But I mention this just to show that this is a real-world issue for public project owners. This is kind of more than a theoretical harm. The second risk, and possibly even the bigger risk, is the insurance language creates a lot of ambiguity, in our opinion. By removing the project-specific insurance language, it leaves a reference to builder's risk insurance, but it doesn't reference a bunch of the other types of insurance that owners typically require on construction projects. Now, each construction project is different, and owners should be able to customize their insurance coverage to the particular risks of a particular project. For the builder's risk, for example, it doesn't actually provide a whole lot of coverage for horizontal projects, road and bridge projects. So we require certain other types of insurance, like general liability insurance. If we have a contractor who's building a bridge pier off a barge, we might require marine liability insurance. We're even getting into the realm of newer technologies like drone insurance and cyber insurance as we have more construction equipment that's kind of becoming automated and data-driven. So we think there is a significant risk here that this insurance, the removal of this insurance language will make it difficult or impossible for owners to tailor their coverage to the project, and that we will end up with risks that are actually uninsured on our projects. I thank you for your consideration, Chair and members, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Coney. Hang around. If there are questions, we'll get done to those at the end. Cameron Boyd. And the next person I have is Laura Ziegler. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Cameron Boyd, and I'm the General Counsel at the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I want to first endorse Mr. Coney's comments there that you just heard with regard to both indemnity, defense, and insurance. I wanted to highlight, I hope in simple terms, the real timing issue that this bill would present for project owners. The bill by its language attempts to limit the duty of defense, which must by its nature be determined at the onset of litigation, according to the extent of fault, which is determined at the end of litigation. And so it simply creates a standard that is nonsensical. The concern becomes that if a party or parties who are named to a lawsuit all merely deny that they had any fault in the matter, then none of them would have to defend, and the bill would effectively eviscerate the duty to defend across the board. This burden of defense is actually quite significant for public entities like mine. Even setting aside the cost of outside counsel, which by the way could be recovered under indemnification, but if the conduct of defense has to be engaged, we have to manage that outside counsel with our staff, our in-house legal staff. Our non-legal staff have to participate in that defense, evaluate, and so on. And this is a real burden for a small legal department like we have at the airport. I also want to point out that it is not in a project owner's interest to be tendering defense for claims for which the owner could possibly be liable. We have every incentive to want the defense to be effective and to control that defense and to make sure that it's executed in a way that's consistent with our organization's values. I'll limit my comments there. I appreciate the time you've given me today.
Thank you for your testimony. And I don't see Laura Ziegler here yet, so next I have Patrick Hines. Oh, Laura. Why don't you let Patrick go? Yeah, let her catch her breath. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with Messerly and Kramer. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Contractor Coalition, which is a group of eight of the largest general contractors doing work in Minnesota. And collectively each year they're responsible for billions of dollars of construction job of construction projects and thousands of construction jobs in the state. I wanted to first apologize to Representative Hollins. I haven't had a chance to meet with her in person yet. I typically would like to do that, so I'm sorry I haven't had a chance yet. But we are testifying in opposition to the bill. And one of the earlier testifiers testifying in support said that the bill was intended to limit risk transfer to a reasonable extent. And that's what the statute does now, because the current statute was the result of a very lengthy negotiation in 2013 where certain contractors came to the legislature and said they believe certain practices requiring them to indemnify others for their fault was unfair. And so the legislature, as a result of that, put into place the current statute, which recognizes the distinction between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify, which has been in place for decades. So this isn't, I also want to note one other point that was made, that there are 40 states that have anti-indemnification statutes. I haven't counted. I assume that's correct. Minnesota's one of them. There is an anti-indemnification statute. It's the one that we're talking about today. The proposed changes to that anti-indemnification statute are about the duty to defend, not about indemnification. And so if I could, I think it would be helpful to talk briefly about what the process of a lawsuit being filed in the construction context looks like. If you have a large construction project with many contractors working on it, let's just say you have the roofer who does the work on this project. The roof leaks. Someone sues because the roof leaks. The suit is about the work performed by the worker. It's not about the work performed by the general contractor, because the general contractor typically doesn't perform that work. The roofer does. And it's certainly not about the owner, whether it be public or private, because the owner is not self-performing the work. So the lawsuit is about, in this case, in my example, the roof. And that roofer will have insurance. And when the lawsuit's filed, it will tender the claim to the insurance company. And the insurance company will only look at the complaint that was filed. And they'll look at it and they'll say, is this entity that was sued, did they have a policy with us? If the answer is yes, they will then see if the policy was in effect at the time of the alleged negligence. And if that answer is yes, then they will look to see if the policy covers their scope of work. So if the policy was for a roofer that covers the roof work, then they will defend that roofer. If for some reason the policy was for, you know, the architect or the landscape architect, then they won't. So that's what we're talking about, and that's how easy it is to initiate a lawsuit. There's not a great deal of investigation. We don't know who is at fault. And importantly for the general contractor, Minnesota law requires the general contractor to be vicariously liable for the work of the subs. So in that lawsuit, the plaintiff will add a paragraph that says, based on information and belief, general contractor X was the general contractor on the project. By operation of Minnesota law, they're vicariously liable. That's it. And so we're not talking about a subcontractor taking responsibility for someone else's work. We're talking about an insurance policy that provides defense for a claim based on that work. And the reason this is important is because if once that claim is initiated, if the general contractor has to have their own defense, we're adding another layer of attorneys, we're adding more costs, we're adding more time, and we're creating a disincentive for the insurance company to settle. Because instead of just defending the one claim with one insurance company, that insurance company now can look around and say, well, maybe we can shift some of that over to there, or we can shift some over to the other policy. So at the end of the day, it's not creating any benefit for the construction industry. It's not creating jobs. It's creating costs. And I would just like to add one more thing in terms of the cost. The reason this negotiated settlement, a compromise in 2013 came about is because the duty to defend is insurable. It's very standard construction insurance. So you're not paying for the attorney's fees. You're paying for an insurance policy that covers those fees. And that insurance policy, the cost is known. And when you're putting forward a bid to a general contractor, the cost of that policy is in your bid. So in my opinion, it doesn't create any sort of unlevel playing field, because all the contractors are operating under the same system. And those costs can be baked into the bids. So I'm sorry, I went a little longer. I thank you for indulging me. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Then Laura Ziegler, and then we'll have questions. Welcome to the committee. Again, state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ziegler. I'm with Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We have over 400 members statewide. We represent both the commercial builders as well as highway heavy.
members. And I just want to thank Representative Hollins for meeting with us earlier to voice our concerns with House File 865. I haven't been able to listen to the entire discussion. I would assume everyone's a construction lawyer by now. Afterwards, a lot of legal terms, but I just kind of want to bring it back a little bit because for our organization, despite our name, we have subcontractors, we have specialty subs, and we have generals. And actually, some general contractors can be a subcontractor and vice versa, depending on the product. It's just the nature of the industry and depending on project size. And this was alluded to earlier, a lot of general contractors don't actually self-perform the work, so it is all subcontracted out in many ways. And so if, I think it was probably said earlier too, that this bill is trying to close a perceived loophole in which a sub could be on the hook if a general contractor was solely negligent. And if that's all this bill does, I would be in front of you in support of the bill. It does much more than that, and I think it was illustrated with prior testimony. So I will move on from that. But the other part of this bill is banning project-specific insurance. So that's in the second half with that new language. This is not something that our members come to and say, please ban insurance products that help us mitigate our risk. It's not something we hear. In fact, we want the insurance products so our contractors can go out, procure it accordingly, and mitigate their risk on different projects. And as there are emerging technologies, such as drones, another project-specific insurance might be watercraft, we want to ensure that our contractors can obtain that. We shouldn't be limiting that in the marketplace for them. So I also want to draw attention to that aspect of the bill for you as well. With that, I will conclude my comments, but we'll be around for any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Siegler. And just again, is anybody else in the audience that needs to speak on this bill, for or against? If not, I've got two people on the list for questions, starting with Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate everybody for coming and making the way back and forth between the Senate. And sort of as a lawyer, I really appreciate whoever submitted the contract to actually look at the language, because I think that that's helpful and grounding. And for the sample contract, just reading it, so subcontractor agrees to defend contractor, its agents and employees, without limitation, claims for which the contractor may be claimed liable and pay all legal fees and disbursements incurred by the contractor in the defense. And I will, I see that we are running low on time, but in the discussion of this year and last year's, I don't think we saw any contracts, if it was just about legal timing, that had the contractor indemnifying for the subcontractors. Negligence, or excuse me, for their conduct. And so this, it's hard for me not to just see this is the big guy making the little guy defend them for their own negligence. And so I think if it was really about the timing issue, and I get it, like as a lawyer, I did some insurance litigation, I get when that starts, but we could just as easily see contracts that say the general contractor, who's really in the best position to see the entire thing, and frankly, financially, usually in a better position to cover the cost of defense, is the one that's on the hook for the insurance. So I really appreciate this bill. It just seems like a very simple fairness that if you are a subcontractor, you shouldn't be contractually liable for covering the big guy for their own defense of their what could be their own conduct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I did not hear a question there, but the next person on my list is Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. If Mr. Hines would answer a question.
We're making sure everyone gets their steps in today,
yep.
Not only coming from the Capitol, but back and forth. Mr. Hines.
Yeah, it's good to see you in here, and I appreciate you coming in to, share that scenario that you provided. And that scenario for me, I just had a follow-up question related to it. On let's say you have an issue in regards to not one as simple as a roofer. Let's say you have a water intrusion and you've got to sue the stucco and you've got to sue the window manufacturer. When it's a little bit harder to figure out what's causing it, does that change your scenario at all? I'm just interested from your experience.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Myers. It's certainly more complicated from just a process standpoint, as I know you know from your legal experience, that a lot of these construction claims involve 10, 12, 15 different parties, but the insurance is still tied to one subcontractor and that subcontractor's scope of work. So in your scenario where if there was water intrusion and it was we're trying to figure out who would, you know, if it's the fault of the window manufacturer or the rough carpenter or the waterproofer or the person who bent the metal over the top of it, I think what would happen in that case is that you have everyone tendering to their insurance, and then that defense is provided to each individual subcontractor. And again, the general contractor who didn't perform any of that work would be defended in some combination by the multiple insurance policies in that case. I mean, it is a little more complicated, but I don't think that changes the dynamic of our testimony.
No, and I appreciate that, because there was some discussion about, you know, trying to figure out who's at fault and the cost and everything else. So that was helpful. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hines. Any further questions? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 865 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill's on its way. Thank you, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Nelson.
Members, with that, that's our agenda is done for today, and we keep the next meet next Tuesday. So with that, members, we are adjourned.